Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Health and Social Services to order at 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 19th. We're meeting room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones. As a courtesy, committee members present are Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, Senator Dunbar, and Vice Chair Kaufman is out on other state business. I am Senator Wilson. We do have a forum to conduct state business this afternoon. We have two items on the agenda. We have SB 233, Child Care Provider Education Requirement by Senator Dunbar. And then we will go to SB 241, Medical Assistant Demonstration Projects by Senate Rules at the request of the governor. And I apologize, my voice does not come back from all the yelling and screaming from Arctic Winter Games this past weekend. First up, we have Senate Bill 233. This is the first time we've heard this a piece of legislation. We have Senator Dunbar and his staff via Smite. Thank you. Here to introduce the bill and to give a sexual analysis. And also for questions for the committee, we have Hillary Porter, the Deputy Director of the Division of Public Assistance, here as well. Senator Dunbar, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Forrest Dunbar, Senator from District J. I'm joined by my intern, Rhea Smike. This is a little bit of a non-traditional bill presentation, in that I'm hoping we can hear from the department about what they are planning to do. I think we all recognize that there is a child care affordability and access crisis in Alaska, and that it harms our state in a variety of ways, that we don't have enough child care providers that are affordable for our families and our workforce. Currently, people who want to enter the profession must have a high school diploma or GED to become a licensed provider in the daycare assistance program. This can limit the number of people entering this profession, especially refugee and immigrant individuals. Many new arrivals have to flee their countries quickly and don't have time to grab documents, spend decades in refugee camps where education may not be available, or come from countries that lack education systems due to political unrest. Many of these folks have the experience needed to thrive in the profession of childcare, but the GED high school diploma requirement provides a barrier for them to enter the profession. Removing this requirement would allow more people into the profession, both new arrivals and longtime residents of Anchorage, while still holding them subject to all the other regulations and requirements of the profession. And we have several people, Mr. Chair, invited testifiers from Catholic Social Services and from the Alaska Literacy Program that can speak to this. I'll say that in my discussions with the department, it is my understanding that they are going to do this by regulation anyway. So we have put forward the bill and we've started this conversation, but if this is done by regulation, we won't need to go through the full legislative process. I'll just say that I hope that this policy change is enacted, and if we could, we have a brief sectional from my intern, Ms. Rhea Smike.
Floor is yours. You can place yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Rhea Smike, intern to Senator Dunbar, and I will be announcing the sectional. Section 1 will allow people to be licensed child care providers in the daycare assistance program without having a high school diploma or a GED.
That's it.
Before we go to your invited testifiers, is there any questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Giesel?
So, Senator Dunbar, one of the things that I hear a lot, maybe you do too, is that the wage for someone working in childcare is very low. And we want to actually raise the status of those childcare staff. So this feels uncomfortable to me because you're actually lowering the qualifications. So what I'm wondering about is, would it be appropriate to create almost like we have a teacher assistant? We have a teacher and a TA, a teaching assistant, right? Could we have a child care provider and a child care assistant category that wouldn't have to have a high school diploma or equivalent?
Thank you, Senator Giesel, through the chair. You know, I'll say that I certainly share your desire to raise wages for the childcare profession. I think that issue is a little bit distinct from this. And we'll hear testimony from folks from RACE, the Refugee and Program at CSS, and the Alaska Literacy Program. I think there are folks who are very qualified and very trained to do this, to be good childcare providers, but they don't have that piece of paper from our government. You know, it's a little bit like last year when we changed the CDL requirements, because we knew folks from Ukraine were perfectly capable of being commercial, you know, having commercial driver's licenses. So we removed the sort of arbitrary requirement for 1 year having an Alaska driver's license. This is a little bit distinct, obviously, because this is an education qualification, but I think that there are alternatives to demonstrating that they are still qualified. And there are other regulatory requirements, I think, that will assure quality in this profession that I think the department can speak to, and certainly the invited testifiers can speak to. Because I agree with you. You know, in general, we want to raise the status and the wages of our child care providers. At the same time, I think we want to be inclusive of the kind of folks that can come into the profession. We want to have alternative qualification standards so folks can come in and demonstrate that they are competent in this profession.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Tolbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Dunbar, for bringing this forth. I know this has been a component that we've talked about quite extensively in the Child Care Task Force, which I do sit on, and discussed about the limitations for some of our immigrant and refugee populations and this barrier to providing in-home care to their fellow community members who might have some concern of someone who's not part of their heritage, their background, watching their kiddos. So I would like to hear from the department, as I know that this is going to be addressed in regulation, and there's a reason why it might be better addressed through the regulatory process, particularly getting to the question around, will there be someone who is on hand or on the staff who do meet those very high benchmarks of requirements when it comes to education, early education credits, business credits, and some of those other pieces? Because it's not like this person will be by themselves. There's a safety net there. And so I think it might be helpful to hear from the department on what that safety net might be.
Can I respond to that briefly, Mr. Chair?
Yes, and then let's have you respond, then we'll go through your invited testifiers, then we can have the department.
Yeah, I just want to agree with you, Senator Tobin, and I think it also goes to the point that Senator Giesel made. The idea of allowing people to provide in-home child care is something I think we all recognize could be an important part of the conversation, but also highlights sort of what Senator Giesel spoke about with the sort of imbalance right now between the kind of compensation and status we can offer these folks and what is practical for families to afford. And I think we are realizing in Alaska what almost every other country in the world has realized, and what a number of states are starting to realize too, that we're going to need to directly provide financial support to this aspect of our economy. The free market does not work in this economy in the same way that it doesn't work in some other vital areas. You know, I think childcare essentially is infrastructure, if that makes sense, to use a phrase that has been used before. So I'll just say thank you. And yes, if we go to my invited testifiers, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. First up, we have Robin Dempsey, the CEO of Catholic Social Services Anchorage. Robin, are you online?
I am.
If you can place yourself on the record and please begin your invited testimony, please.
Oh, great. Thank you. So my name is Robin Dempsey, and I am the CEO of Catholic Social Services, and I'm here on behalf of CSS to testify in support of SB 233. As an agency focused on encouraging stable income and promoting permanent stability, we work closely with individuals from diverse backgrounds on securing employment. Particularly among the women in our Refugee Assistance and Immigration Service, which is also known as RAISE, we hear two main concerns from mothers who want to obtain employment. The first is difficulty finding childcare in Anchorage, preventing them from leaving the home to work. And the second is the struggle to find childcare and leaving their children in the care of someone who does not understand their culture and does not speak the same language. I think we all know Anchorage needs more childcare providers, and specifically more culturally appropriate and multilingual providers. Meanwhile, Catholic Social Services works with a lot of women and individuals who have child care experience coming from these diverse backgrounds. Yet these individuals with precisely the desired experience are not able to apply for open child care positions because they do not have a GED. A GED requirement provides no meaningful measurement of whether an individual is a competent child care provider or if they have child care experience. This bill and its removal of the arbitrary requirement will help dozens of people, including RAISE clients, who have proven competent child care experience to enter employment. It will simultaneously expand the number of child care providers, especially culturally appropriate child care providers in our state. This is an issue that impacts not only Anchorage, but our entire state. In the last 4 years, RAISE has grown from welcoming 21 new arrivals in 2021 to 582 people in 2023. So this is an increase of 250%, especially through the Uniting for Ukraine program and the new sponsorship program. These new Alaskans are now resettled across the state from Delta Junction to Juneau. I believe strongly that this bill and its removal of the GED requirement will open up many new employment opportunities while simultaneously improving our state's child care system as a whole. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Robin, for your testimony this afternoon. Are there any questions for this invited testifier? Seeing none, thank you again. Next, staying with Catholic Social Services, we have Bridget Reynolds. Bridget, if you can place yourself on the record and please begin your testimony.
Hello, I'm Bridget Reynolds, and I am the Program Director at Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services, also known as RAISE. We are a program of Catholic Social Services, and we're based in Anchorage. And today I'm here to testify in support of SB 233, which is sponsored by Senator Dunbar, which aims to repeal the GED requirement for child care providers in Alaska. I strongly believe that this requirement poses unnecessary obstacles for individuals who have valuable child care experience. In my role, I work closely with refugees and new arrivals in Alaska, and in the last few years, we've welcomed hundreds of people, primarily from Ukraine, Afghanistan, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. RAISE works to support all of these individuals, providing them with the tools and means to become self-sufficient. Through our employment services, we offer targeted assistance, working to provide clients with the opportunity to support their families while contributing to our Alaskan economy. Many of these individuals possess significant child care experience and are eager to contribute to our community. However, many mothers encounter challenges entering the workforce due to child care responsibilities. Anchorage currently faces a long daycare waitlist and a shortage of culturally appropriate child care options. Parents express concern about entrusting their young children to providers who do not speak their language or understand their cultures. What our community urgently needs are more child care providers, particularly those who are culturally sensitive and multilingual. This is especially important in Anchorage, where we have over 100 languages spoken by students in the school district. At RAISE, we serve many clients with exceptional child care expertise who come from diverse backgrounds and are fluent in multiple languages. These individuals are skilled and compassionate caregivers, precisely the kind our community requires, and many of them would love to pursue positions at daycare. However, the current GED requirement poses a significant barrier, and despite possessing extensive experience, many of these individuals are ineligible due to the absence of a GED certificate. Eliminating the GED requirement empowers people with invaluable childcare experience to enter the workforce. It expands the availability of childcare and addresses a pressing need for providers who comprehend the diverse backgrounds of the families that they serve. Thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you, Bridget. Are there any questions for Ms. Reynolds? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony this afternoon. Next invited testifier is Asia Amini Armini.
Hello, I am Asia Amini, the Refugee Education and Employment Food Services Specialist at RAISE. I am from Afghanistan. I have been in Alaska for 2 years now with my two young children. I am also a peer leader navigator with Alaska Literacy Program, where I assist my community. Today, I am testifying in support of SB 233 to remove the GED requirement for child care providers. Right now, there are a lot of barriers for women in Alaska from Afghanistan and other countries. Many women in my community want to work, but they cannot because they are at home with small children. Currently, daycare waitlists are very long. It takes 1 or 2 years to get a child in daycare. I have one friend who waited for 1 year and never heard back from any daycare. When she asked, they told her that it is difficult because she does not speak English. We need more daycare workers who speak Pashto or Dari, the language of Afghanistan. However, the GED requirement is a big barrier. Many Afghan women in our community want to work, especially in daycare, but the GED requirement makes it hard. Getting a GED takes many years. I have been working online for 2 years now. There are a lot of women with experience as a mother who would be very interested in working at daycare, but they cannot. If the GED requirement is removed, one woman can watch 5 to 6 kids. Then more women can apply for other jobs because they do not have small kids at home anymore. Removing the GED requirement can help remove this barrier for Afghan women and women from many other countries. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Amini? Seeing none, thank you for providing your testimony this afternoon. Last invited testifier is Laura Pickett, CEO of Alaska Literacy Program.
Hi, this is Lori Pickett, and I'm testifying for Alaska Literacy Program. Thank you, everyone, for your time today, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to testify in support of Senator Dunbar's SB 233, a crucial step towards removing the barrier requiring providers to have a GED or high school diploma in order to participate in the Child Care Assistance Program. At Alaska Literacy Program, we provide adult learners with education and training to learn job skills, acquire the GED, help their children in school, access healthcare, become citizens, navigate their new home country, and more. Last year, we served 892 students from 72 different countries who speak 56 languages. We are on track to serve over 1,000 students this year. Many of these students come to us having fled war, economic and political unrest, and unstable conditions that have prevented them from completing formal education or being able to access their high school records in their home country. There is a critical statewide gap in our workforce that is greatly impacted by the lack of childcare. Seeking to eliminate barriers for both workers and childcare providers is in the public's best interest. The requirement of holding a GED or high school diploma does not inform a person's ability to participate in childcare services. This requirement hinders our immigrant population from contributing fully to our society, both in accessing care so they may enter the workforce and in expanding the pool of qualified providers. Through the unique combination of cultural values, strong work ethic, and nurturing instincts that many immigrants embody, they will contribute greatly to the pool of childcare providers. Many come from cultures that prioritize family, community, and the importance of caring for children. Immigrants bring with them a wealth of talent, skills, and ambition that help fill crucial gaps in our workforce, but also bring fresh perspectives and ideas that fuel innovation and growth. Having a pool of professionally skilled individuals in fields like medicine, technology, and engineering to entrepreneurs who start businesses and create jobs are integral to Alaska's economic success. Please support SB 233. It's an opportunity to continue the success by paving similar professional pathways in childcare services, and it only happens when unnecessary barriers are removed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pickett. Are there any questions for Ms. Pickett? Seeing none, thank you for being available this afternoon to provide invited testimony. We'll now quickly open up public testimony. Is anyone here in the room like to testify in SB 241? Seeing none, and seeing no one online, we will go ahead and close public testimony. If you want to provide a comment, you can to our email address at shss@akleg.gov, and we'll go ahead and close public testimony. We have two individuals from the department. We have Hillary Porter, the Deputy Director of Public Health Division, here in the room. And we also have Amber Mavis online, who is the program coordinator with the Department of Health. And not in the room? Oh, okay. you want to come to the, I believe there's questions from the committee members. And if you'd like to defer to your other lifeline online, feel free to.
I'm not sure if she's online.
Oh, no, we have Amber Mavis.
She's
online, yes.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Hillary Porter, Deputy Director for Public Assistance. And I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
All right. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, I've had some discussions with the department. It sounds like there is a regulatory change that is planned that will hopefully resolve this issue. Could you just describe it a little bit?
Yeah, certainly. For the record, Hillary Porter, Deputy Director of Public Assistance, through the Chair, Senator Dunbar. Yes, we currently have drafted a regulation change removing the GED requirement. We've submitted that, and it is currently being under review. And this was a barrier that was identified through the task force. So we look forward to the change.
Before, can you describe what task force we're referring to?
Oh, I'm sorry, the Governor's Task Force on Child Care.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
I mean, I'm certainly satisfied with that answer. I don't know if anyone else has any other changes. I guess I would ask, because you're involved in that, so if it's all right, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So Senator Kiesel raised, I think, a good point about trying to raise the status and maintain the quality of our child care. And I'm sort of wondering what efforts the department might be engaged in to do that while simultaneously removing barriers like this one.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, there have been a lot of conversations about wages for child care workers through the Governor's Task Force on Child Care. The department is looking at those comments and considering options. I can't speak too much more to that, but I would say that we are aware of that and we're looking into it, how we can improve that.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. And I'm hopeful that you might be able to talk a little bit about some of the health and safety concerns that folks might have by removing this requirement for folks that at least a high school diploma or a GED. What are some of the additional safeties and some of the other components that might help to ensure the public that it's not going to be a wild, wild west of childcare while folks out there not protecting our most vulnerable Alaskans?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Tobin. Quality is a major focus when we talk about childcare, and including the workers that work in it. You know, there is training through THRED, our childcare, statewide childcare resource and referral. You might have heard of the term SEED and ROOTS. Those are ways to acknowledge childcare workers and sort of what they've attained through various types of training, whether it's through the university, whether it's through THRED, whether it's through Learn and Grow, which is another organization. I apologize that I don't know all the different levels of the training, but I believe there are about 13 stands out in my mind, maybe a few less, but there are certain levels that workers can achieve, and that essentially makes them highly qualified in the childcare workforce. So while they may not have a GED or a high school diploma, quality is still a major focus and a requirement of any provider and any worker.
A follow-up, Senator Tobin?
Thank you. And maybe without going through all of the 13 different levels, but what are some of the other qualifications that someone might need to meet, the other standards like CPR training or some of the other components that are involved with becoming a provider?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Tobin. Yes, health and safety. So background checks are a requirement and part of our quality initiatives. If you just give me 1 second here. Licensing. You're still required to, obtain a business license. You must be 18 years, at least 18 years old. So again, an adult. I think I'll leave it at that, if that's okay.
All right. Senator Diesel.
So this is very helpful to know that there are training programs. So Are individuals required to take some kind of training program?
Yes, they are encouraged and required to take training. What levels they attain, I think that's where you have options. So you can take one level or you can go the full way and get sort of a certificate, which, again, maybe not a diploma or a GED, but it's a certificate that recognizes the training and qualifications of that particular provider or worker.
Senator Giesel.
Very good. So follow up to that. So will the individuals, despite not having a GED or equivalent, still be required to understand the laws we have surrounding child safety? Mandatory reporting, for example, if there's any suspected abuse, things like that.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, yes, compliance is part of our process as well. So although somebody may get licensed, they will have inspections done. I believe it's twice a year. One is planned and one is unplanned. And so, again, ensuring that providers are keeping up with quality, keeping qualified people employed. If there is an issue, we have a way to sort of address that and work with the provider to become compliant again.
Follow up.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
So that's good, and it's what you're kind of describing, I think, is a child care facility. At least it sounds like it when you're talking about employing others, etc. But I'm talking about in-home child care. What will be required for those providers to know and understand about our laws?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, the requirements are essentially the same, whether it's in-home or a facility, in terms of being compliant with all the licensing rules.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have a question on, I know the department's looking at this one regulation. Are there other regulations that we're maybe looking at that may be hindrance that the task force identified? I guess an example might be in terms of like outdoor play area for infants. If I wanted to be a child care provider and I had to just want to take three infants, but I still have to have the yard space outside, are we looking at trying to have regulation changes to be a little more flexible for those type of situations?
To the chair, specifically to that, I will say that there have been conversations about potential regulation changes. Specifically to that, we have not engaged in making any of those changes.
So I guess for right now, we're only looking at this one item of terms of the high school or just lowering the or having basically a skill-based equivalency or just getting rid of a high school diploma equivalency is the only regulatory change the department is looking at right now in terms of child care providers.
To the chair, there are other changes in our licensing regulations that we're working on. I have them in front of me.
And by all means, you don't have to read them all out. If you could just provide them to the committee, to my office, we can distribute them to the committee as well. I don't want you to, let's say you're about to go through the whole list of sheets. It looks like a large document in front of you.
I think you should, to punish the chair.
To the chair, we'd be happy to give you some more information around those licensing regulation changes.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
So a question, a regulatory package typically takes about a year. Where are you in the stage of this change?
We have just submitted them. I believe they are at the Department of Law currently. We, in our package, we requested a July 1 effective date. So hopeful that we can achieve that.
All right, Senator Giesel.
Follow up. So you've already had public comment?
We have not. We have not got to that phase. Oh, excuse me, through the chair, Senator Giesel. No, we haven't got to the public comment phase yet.
Follow up.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
So again, thinking about the timeline, I don't know, I've served on a regulatory board. It takes a year, right? Public, you get it from law, you put it out for public hearing. You know, where will public hearing come in on this, public feedback?
And believe you're getting a lifeline from
DC.
Through
the chair, I have a lifeline.
DC Ritchie, if you can place yourself on the record.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and Senator Geisel. The regulatory packages can vary in the length of time it takes to complete the regulatory process. Some of that depends on the extent of changes that are being considered, as well as the volume of public comment. I know that the Division of Public Assistance, along with the Commissioner's Office, is working very closely with the Child Care Task Force in that work. I believe this is the regulations that Deputy Director Porter has described relative to the GED requirement. Those are underway. How long that process takes, again, is dependent on some of the various factors that we've talked about. But I do know that the department is considering, you know, potentially additional changes in alignment with the work that's being undertaken at the task force. I would envision that there are going to be multiple dates that these regulatory changes are approved and rolled out and made available, again, depending on the work of the task force.
Senator Geisel.
Well, that still leaves the question of you haven't had public comment yet. That will take a period of time. You'll have to have it noticed, etc. So July 1st, is that actually a real date?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. That is our goal. Whether we're able to make that goal or not remains to be seen, but I believe that is our goal at this time.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the department? I do. I just want to say hi to Amber. We used to work together many moons ago, and when I had a little bit more hair on my head and when it was a little bit blacker.
Hello.
Other than that, are there comments or any questions for, yes, Senator Telvin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not a question, but a comment. We had a great presentation in Senate Education about the current progress of the Child Care Task Force, and I think it would be helpful for us here in this committee to hear how those changes and some of the work that the task force is doing dovetails with programs like Parents as Teachers, which is part of the Department of Health, and will help us understand some of the work that is currently being done.
All right, well, we can see if we can get something scheduled here in the near future. Any other comments for the bill sponsor? Did the bill sponsor have any comments he'd like to make in closing?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you for hearing this bill. Thank you to the department for working with my office and for presenting today. And to the testifiers, I know they testified in favor of this bill, but the bill isn't what's important. What's important is the change. And I believe the change can be achieved and will be achieved through regulation. So again, I want to say thank you to the department, and I do not intend to move this bill forward any further. Although certainly if that regulatory change were to fall through, I would bring it back next year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, with that, we'll just pull this bill aside and won't set an amendment deadline. And we will move on to our next item of business. We'll take a brief at ease. We are back on the record, and our last item of business this afternoon is Senate Bill 241, Child Care Tax Credits and Assistance Grants. We, as advertised, we had the House Companion, but we are not yet in possession of that, so we're going to take up the Senate version of 241, sorry, Medicaid Assistance Administration Projects. Sorry about that. That's next week. It's our next Thursday, that's our bill. Here to provide a brief introduction of this legislation, we have Commissioner Hedberg online from the Commissioner of Department of Health, and here in the room, we have the marvelous, wonderful, infamous Dr. Ann Zink. One of the last times we may see her in her role as Chief Medical Officer, and with her at the table is D.C. Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie. Commissioner Hedberg, the floor is yours. If you can place yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health, and I want to thank the Senate Committee for considering Senate Bill 241, Medical Assistance Demonstration Projects. This bill will give the Department of Health permission to apply for a Medicaid demonstration waiver, which is really designed to make Alaskans healthier and reduce healthcare costs. And with that, I will now pass it over to Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer, and Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner, to present this bill before you. Thank you.
Great. And for the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer, State of Alaska, and I'm going to hand it over to D.C. Ritchie, who's going to get us started.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I just want to echo the comments from Commissioner Hedberg and thank the committee for hearing SB 241. So as moving on to slide two, as the committee is well aware, Medicaid is really a critical element of Alaska's healthcare delivery system, both for Alaska and for the nation. And the Medicaid program covers about 38% of Alaskans, and so it is an important it is a critical insurer within the state, and it also shapes a healthcare delivery system which responds ultimately to what it is being paid for and the services provided. And as this committee is well aware, healthcare expenditures in Alaska and in the United States are very high. And so one of the things that, we kind of want to think about it at state level and within the Department of Health is given the investments that we're making at a state and a national level in our healthcare system, are we seeing the outcomes that we would expect based on the amount of investments we're seeing? And if we're not, we really need to look at our different systems and try to identify ways that we can leverage those investments to improve outcomes within that system. And when you look at a system like Alaska, where Medicaid is a really important component of the healthcare delivery system and the insurance system, we have an opportunity with a Medicaid program to address some of those unmet needs or to identify those gaps in the system where, you know, we're seeing a difference between the investment we're making and the outcomes we're seeing in the people that we're covering. And ultimately, that's what we're here to talk about today. So moving on to slide three, this slide is really a graphical depiction of a concept in health insurance that I think members of the committee may be aware of. But the horizontal axis on the bottom really talks about kind of the percentage of Medicaid beneficiaries, and then the vertical axis associates that percentage with spend. And what this demonstrates is that about 5% of beneficiaries account for 50% of the spend, or really in our Medicaid program, about $1.3 billion in state fiscal year 23. And about 10% of Medicaid beneficiaries account for 67% of our spend, so almost two-thirds of that, which is $1.7 billion. So if we're thinking about the Medicaid program moving forward, we're thinking about how to create a sustainable program, and we're thinking about ways where we might be able to intervene to improve both the outcomes and the fiscal sustainability of the program. You know, we look at those areas where we have people with high acute needs that are engaging in the system consistently. And today we're going to talk about some of those needs and some alternatives that the Medicaid program can look at to address some unmet needs that's disproportionately affecting this percentage, this portion of the population. So moving on to slide four, this is another way to think about individuals with acute needs that, you know, are utilizing the healthcare system, but maybe not in the most efficient or appropriate way possible. And so this graph really outlines the number of patients that have had more than 10 visits in an emergency department a year, as well as the median visits of those individuals. And again, you see a smaller portion of the population with very acute needs that are utilizing the system at highly intense levels.
And just a question here on the slide. you don't have this broken down into the types of visits, ER visits, if this is medical or behavioral health?
Chair Wilson, Emily Ricci for the record. When we did break out the data and look at it in more detail, and I know Dr. Zink has spent a lot of time on this chart, so I'm going to pass it over to her to speak to this in more detail, but a behavioral health diagnosis was found in a high percentage of these cases.
Yeah, for the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer of the State of Alaska. I would echo DC Ricci and Commissioner Hedberg's gratitude for hearing this bill. In looking at this slide and specifically the question you're asking about behavioral health diagnosis, this is part of what drove me into policy in the first place, was seeing patients cycling through the emergency department time and time again and not getting the care that they needed, and seeing the amount of money and time that we were spending, yet not doing what was really what is needed for that patient because the way that our system was set up. I've come to terms with the fact that awful things do happen to patients, but systems that we control oftentimes are failing our patients. And these are systems that we have the ability to change and to improve, and what really drove me into this space in the first place. Looking at this data here, we can happy to provide with you offline, but essentially those highest utilizers, those greater than 75 visits a year, all of them had behavioral health diagnosis coded for them in the last 6 months as well. You know, what is the chicken and what is the egg in that space? It can always be hard to tell. If someone has heart failure, a bad autoimmune disease, they start to then have, you know, degenerative bone disease. They start to break more bones. They then need opioids to control those pain. Then they become depressed because of everything cycling through. That can be a really depressing situation. I oftentimes say how healthcare is paid for. The mind and body are one, except for how we pay for the system. And when you really hurt, it's very depressing. And when you're very depressed, it very much hurts. And so the two are very closely connected. But we do see in the highest utilizers a high percentage of behavioral health diagnosis as well.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to ask a question, and you can always punt it. What is the intersection on dental? Thinking about folks who have plaque buildup and then they have unfortunate consequences due to that. And then also the breakdown of age in this high utilizers, the median visits, and then the very low number of patients. Are they older folks? They tend to be younger folks. Are they, I'm going to say middle age, but I actually don't know what middle aged is. Do you have some information on that? I don't think we're middle aged.
Senator Tobin, through the chair, I will not comment on which category different people are on, but we are happy to provide a larger age breakdown for you. Alaska data can be very challenging in this role. So you see on here, we've got 7 patients who have had 100 or more visits, with the highest utilizer having over 200 visits per year. But we've had patients who have had over 300 visits a year for almost a decade, and they've passed away. And so that one age group or that one condition then suddenly kind of falls off because that one individual who's really driving it. So I'm always hesitant in small numbers to make generalization as well. So as we go through this data, we will be talking about modifiable chronic conditions. We will be talking about both state data as well as national data, because oftentimes we do need to look at national data. Regarding dental specifically, this waiver very much looks at health-related needs, such as food and transportation and housing, which we'll be speaking to. So we'll be talking about diet-sensitive conditions, but we didn't break out specifically on dental conditions. I also would say as a physician, that can be hard to account for, right? If someone has increasing inflammation that has led to cardiovascular disease, I may just see in the emergency department that they're presenting with a heart attack, and that is what I'm putting in my chart and my note. But all of the things that led up to that can be very hard. So specifically something like dental care can be hard to be attributed on an individual level when you're looking at Alaska data versus if you're looking larger at population level data, if that makes sense.
I'm just gonna, you know, we were at another healthcare conference and a lot of people use teeth and they call them luxury bones because most insurance companies don't take care of those items and they also fester. And so I'm sure we're going to talk about the next slide is some of those chronic conditions. And so we need to take care of those items because not sort of luxury bones, but they're lead to other major conditions.
Thank you. And to the chair, and moving on to the next slide, we very much are focused on thinking about the whole person. And so behavioral health, mental health, physical health, teeth are part of our health, all fit into this. But we have just different ways that we can look at the data. This is another way to look at the data, and this isn't super surprising. If someone does not have a chronic condition, they tend to be less expensive for the system. If they have multiple chronic conditions, it tends to be much more expensive for the system. So here, this is Alaska Medicaid data, and you can see that if you've got 8 or more chronic conditions, your average annual cost goes up significantly, up to $81,000. So again, not super surprising in those lines. I would highlight that there are modifiable chronic conditions and there's non-modifiable chronic conditions. And so there's certain things that we have the ability to control based on what we eat, what we do, and there's other things that can be very challenging. And it can also be difficult to code differently on those things. So speaking generally about Alaska, we know that over 2/3 of Alaskans have one or more chronic conditions. And if we look specifically at what's diet modifiable, we know that 68% of Alaskans are obese, 31% have hypertension, 27% have high cholesterol, 8% have diabetes, and 5% have heart disease. Again, there's going to be a multifactorial component to many of those diseases. There may be genetics, there's lifestyle, there's environmental exposure, but the diet can also make a definite impact on that. This even becomes more exaggerated when you look at the deaths. So the vast majority of deaths in Alaska are attributed to a diet-modifiable condition. So cancer, heart disease, diabetes, stroke, and so forth. Not all, but the vast majority. Of that. We also know that for cost, we know that just, you know, having one chronic condition increases your cost about $7,500 per individual. So the more that we can think about how to address these chronic conditions earlier, the more we can think about how we can save costs as well as increase lifespan overall. And as we talk through this waiver and what we're hoping to pursue, I would just highlight that this is one avenue, but this is not the only way that the Department of Health is looking at addressing chronic conditions. So you may have heard of Fresh Start, which is a program that public health stepped forward where every Alaskan can go today to freshstart.alaska.gov and get free resources to address these chronic conditions as an attempt to really try to do everything we can to drive down some of these chronic conditions and make it as easy as possible for clinicians overall. So in our process of learning about what Alaskans are doing and how we're doing it, we really spent time listening to other Alaskans and trying to get a better sense of what was happening and what wasn't happening across the state. And listen to many different regions and how they were addressing chronic conditions. So two programs up here and a third one I wanted to highlight was first is the YKHC program. Oh, looks like your screen went down. My screen was fine. The YKHC food program. So this began in 2018 with a local farmer market and is really specifically targeted towards diabetes. And so they are doing grant-funded work to increase the food for patients with diabetes. So say an elder with diabetes or say a woman with gestational diabetes trying to make sure that their nutritional intake is better aligned with the needs that they have as a diabetic to try to improve their outcomes as a whole. Bartlett is another program here just in Juneau on the what's called the MVP program, the multi-visit person program. And so that is a program that is doing care coordination, looking at food, housing, and transportation for patients who are cycling through the emergency department or hospital for an extended stay. So really doing a lot of great work to keep patients out of the hospital, keeping patients supported in community, and so really hearing from them. And a third one that's not up here, but that I know that Chair Wilson and others know quite a bit about is the HUMS program out in Mattsu, which again was started to look at some of those most frequent ED utilizers, and they have additional data looking at, like from their fourth year, they estimated approximately $5 million savings when they were looking at their 120 participants when they were estimating on ED and hospitalization avoidance overall. So again, cost savings. And when they looked at where they were spending their money, the majority of their money was spent on things like lodging, food, and transportation, which is what this waiver is specifically meant to address. So we're seeing places around the state already working on trying to address these health-related needs to try to keep people healthy and in community. I want to talk now about what are health-related needs. I like this pyramid because I think it's important to take it in context for other programs that are out there. This waiver is not meant to replace all food or all transportation or all housing needs, but is really to be that very, very top of the pyramid for time-limited and medically necessary care where it's not being provided in other ways. So actually, CMS is very clear that this cannot replace SNAP. This cannot replace other population health food policies and programs. So it has to be very specific in who it addresses and targets because this is very much related to patients with high healthcare costs and needs. And I'm going to go through some examples of who those patients are to kind of provide some context to really think about what this looks like. The other thing that I would just emphasize on this slide as well is I like to think about this in terms of trying to maximize the investment that we've made on a hospitalization. So if someone has been hospitalized for heart failure or someone has been hospitalized for an acute psychiatric condition and then is discharged, without that health-related support system around them, oftentimes they can revert back to the condition that resulted in their hospitalization in the first place, driving up readmission and rehospitalization. That's where we see a lot of this cost associated, is that rehospitalization as well as ED admissions. So let's just start with an example from nutrition services. So this is where there's actually quite a bit of data coming from multiple states. Multiple states have already had waivers similar to this. So for example, you have a woman who is pregnant and has gestational diabetes. She has a time-limited medical condition where she needs additional support to make sure that her sugars are well controlled, not only for her health, but also for the health of her baby, to make sure that that baby is delivered safely, doesn't suffer an anoxic brain injury, and the lifelong costs and devastation that can be associated with that. Another example might be someone who was admitted to the hospital with a heart attack, and now they have heart failure. And so suddenly their diet needs to significantly change. They can't eat a high-salt diet because they will rapidly come back to the emergency department with increasing swelling, and they have to manage their potassium and their sodium and all of these things that are new to them. And if they don't have a good way to do that, they're oftentimes run back into the hospital and oftentimes being readmitted. So nutritional services may be nutritional education, they may be groceries delivered, or they could be meals delivered. So there's multiple different tailored ways depending on that person's need. So if I have a patient who has heart failure and they're being discharged to a hotel and their main source of food is microwave meals, that's someone who may really benefit from meals that are delivered to them. Versus I have a mom who's got gestational diabetes, who's got the ability to shop and the ability to cook, and she really needs just some education on the foods that she can eat to help control her diabetes. That may just be those nutrition services. And what we see from Massachusetts and from other states is that we saw the total net savings was about somewhere around 16% for those individuals when you match populations. So you looked at a group that had medically tailored meals associated with their support, and you had another group who didn't have that. The group that had the medically tailored meals had a net savings of about 16% of their total healthcare costs. And that's thinking about admissions. Another way, the Massachusetts study showed that they saw 70% fewer inpatient admissions and 72% fewer emergency department transportation when they were able to provide medically tailored meals.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. So I'm curious, I'm going to use Crohn's disease, someone who's an undiagnosed Crohn's disease. They have chronic inflammation. It keeps presenting. They end up looking for services. Does this also include, or could it potentially include, allergy testing or trying to identify what some of those autoimmune responses might be stemming from? Or is that a different diagnostic or a different process?
Yes, Senator Tobin, through the chair, allergy testing right now as a component of Medicaid can be covered depending on the needs of that patient. So this is really thinking about those things that are outside of the traditional healthcare system. CMS has made numerous waivers that they've approved already. How we apply for it can be very broad or very narrow, and we have not yet started the process of applying. Part of it is we need legislative approval to be able to go through that process. So we need to, and we'll go through and kind of talk about where we're at in that steps later on in it, but we need to begin that process to say how much do we want to apply for in this waiver and how much do we need to still move forward.
And yes, follow up, and I have questions.
Yeah. I think I poorly asked my question. So in the idea of after this analysis, then potentially are able to apply for this waiver and approve this waiver, and you come back and you explain to us what we might be doing, and then we say yes, and we go through that whole step. Someone who continually presents in the hospital with inflammation and goes to the allergy testing and then needs to have meal service based on the fact that they now have identified Crohn's disease as a potential contributor to their poor health, would that be covered on something like this, or am I missing the mark?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. One of the reasons that you probably see us hesitating is because, again, we're talking about those supports that may not be traditionally thought of in the healthcare as being part of healthcare. But the way other states have designed their waivers, really the definition of what types of medical, conditions have access to these types of services can be defined by the state through the waiver process and through the state program. So if that's something that this state decided in its analysis was of value to Alaskans, was to support to the Alaska Medicaid program, was to provide, again, time-limited prescription support for an individual with Crohn's disease, that's something we could consider. But I would say when we're looking at other states, we tend to see a more narrow framework, again, focusing on those conditions where you're seeing like very frequent readmission and kind of higher cost utilization. But we have an opportunity to define that.
Brief follow-up. I'm particularly thinking of indigenous populations, and I'm going to use dairy, where we might have some unique characteristics of our state because of our unique population. So thinking about those aspects of where we might have Alaskans who have poor health because we are using a kind of a Western food system that should not necessarily be applied holistically across the state because we have populations that don't necessarily interact with those particular items as well.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, you know, I think we have met fairly extensively with stakeholders, but it's just like the initial process. Part of what the department will do through this waiver process is to continue to meet extensively with stakeholders, tribal health organizations, groups around the state. And so to the degree that, you know, issues that ideas come up, we'll evaluate it through that process. I think right now what you will hear from frequently and what we heard in a lot of our stakeholder engagements was a desire for really clear delineations of what this will and will not do. And our response is we are at the beginning of the process. We are exploring that. We will need to bring on a lot of contractual and actuarial work to identify again what ends up being the best fit for Alaska's Medicaid program. But we're open to input, and we're still in that exploratory stage.
This looks like two different waivers. Are we combining sort of, I know there is the Medicaid had the social determinants of health, social drivers of health sort of waiver process, and sort of the food as medicine waiver. And it looks like now we're adding transportation. So are we sort of looking at just asking for permission to do, asking to do health-related needs and just combining all the waivers that are out there, and we're going to apply for multiple individual waivers, or are we trying to do an omnibus waiver?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. When I think about, I'm going to step back for a second, because when I think about 1115 waivers, that's essentially a tool that the federal government has given states to cover these different types of services. And whether that ends up being most effectively covered through modifying our existing 1115 waiver or through applying for a new 1115 waiver, I think that's what we need to work through both with our consultants and with CMS to identify what's going to be the most effective approach. I would not envision the state would put forward, five different waivers, 1115 waivers for each of these different types of services. Typically, what I've seen in looking at other states' waivers is that they combine them in either one or two waivers that are covering related topics. So I would envision that we would move forward with that. But this is an area that is changing fairly rapidly. And so what the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services is approving for states is being updated almost on like a 120-day or a six-month process. So what we have proposed in this legislation is authorization to apply for a waiver that includes those kind of buckets that we know states are looking at now and that CMS has put forward as part of kind of a streamlined 1115 process relative to those topics. Again, what the final product looks like, we are far from knowing what that is today, but we don't want to start down that path without this legislative approval, because we know that we need that in order to finish the application. And these applications are highly time intensive and resource intensive.
Correct. And I just, and listening to some other states and how CMS has approved waivers, the ones that they approve are most likely written to the guidance, and just wondering how many waivers are we looking at sort of, I guess some of the concern would be blanket authority to say, apply for all the waivers you want. Sort of that without sort of coming back to the legislature and say, well, what's the cost? What's this? What's the implication? So just trying to get a better understanding of what the department's trying to apply and what you're actually trying to accomplish. I understand the goals and I agree with the goals, but I think just being cautious of our legislative authority of applying for waivers or reapplying for waivers, because once you have a waiver, my understanding is you guys can just continue to do whatever waiver you want to do in behavioral health. You can modify it without coming back for legislative approval, or you can just sort of cancel or do other items with that. And so this has just been a conversation I know we've been having with the administration on just the use of waiver authority and how that's being utilized within the state and the statutes. So I just, the chair's concerned. That's just my concern. We can continue on. You don't have to address.
And to the chair, Senator, to the chair, Senator Wilson, again, for the record, Dr. Anzing, as you have mentioned, many states have 1115. Some have one that they constantly are updating. Some have many, many that they're doing on a regular basis. There's other types of waivers. But CMS has specifically come out and said that health-related social needs play a major driver in healthcare costs, and we would like states to take a look at it. And so this bill is specifically to health-related social needs and is the components of that that CMS have put forward. So as you know, we have an 1115 waiver specifically on behavioral health. And so that's why really in talking to the law, this was very different. This was separate. This is why we really came to you all to say this does not fit under the behavioral health 1115 waiver, even though you can tie many of the behavioral health diagnoses to health-related social needs, that we really did need to come back to you, and we want to come back to you all to say this is a way that we think that we can help improve the health and well-being of Alaskans and help to defer the cost and really make use of the sustained investment in hospitalization so that we don't see it again. So that was the conversations that we've had and why we bring this forward back to you all.
And Senator Wilson is, again, I know the committee is well aware, for the record, this is Emily Ricci and his experience longer than I have. Ultimately, the budget authority for the Medicaid program, you know, is appropriated by the legislature. And so any sort of budgetary impact for the Medicaid program will have to be reviewed and approved by the legislature through the legislative process. There are guardrails with 1115s regarding federal budget neutrality as well. And so there will be, I'm sure there will be a financial component to this. Some states allow, or some states have leveraged, many states have leveraged the ability to draw down federal savings that are anticipated with a program in the beginning of the process and to use those savings to invest in the system to support that transformation. So that's one financial component that I would like this, that I would envision we would pursue if it makes sense. Again, we need to undertake this work, but that would be something where we would need to come back to the legislature, of course, through that budgetary appropriation process and make sure that we have that appropriations approval to move forward. So there are going to be checks and balances with the legislature before we can implement these changes.
And I understand that. I guess my concern was more on a reapplication of an approved waiver. For example, the state just went through a reapplication of the current 1115 waiver without any legislative approval, oversight, or any items, even though we did not really fully implement the first 1115 waiver. So there was no modifications, no changes. We're just continuing on. And that just sort of left the entire sort of oversight of the legislature. We're just going to continue on with a waiver that had some issues on the implementation period of that waiver, according to, you know, the reports that we saw on where the status was of the current 1115 waiver. And I guess that's some of my concern, is sort of where we're at in terms of how these waivers get implemented and just sort of lack of our involvement within the waiver process. They're important, don't get me wrong. I see the value of the waivers, and was just also wondering on an amendment for this waiver and looking at additional authority to look at maybe the DOC waiver process in terms of allowing inmates that are near release to be qualified for Medicaid as well. I know other states have looked at that, and you guys don't have to apply for that, but just it's an opportunity to give that opportunity for additional authority to view that if you guys seem in the future, but we can continue.
Senator Wilson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, and I would just add that the department is looking at some of the new opportunities for incarcerated individuals to provide support pre-release for incarcerated individuals in reviewing the existing work that was undertaken through SB 74 and the 1115 authorizing language. The activities that are made available by CMS for the reentry waiver, we believe, are covered under the existing statutory language with the 1115 behavioral health waiver, as they really relate to behavioral health and substance use services. So we are exploring that. That is not explicitly included in this bill because we believe that the statutory authority already exists to pursue those services. So, but the department is very aware of that, and we're kind of thinking through what that could look like in Alaska.
Thank you. I know we've had these conversations off record. I just wanted to put them on the record.
Yeah.
So thank you.
For the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer of the State of Alaska. One last thing I'll just highlight on the nutrition services before I'm going to head into another example and we'll go through food. It is when CMS has approved these kind of across the board, they need to have both, the definition of the service needs to have both a medical and a social component. So to Senator Tobin's comment earlier about someone with Crohn's disease, they would need to have a medical condition and a social need where they couldn't meet that need in and of itself on its own. So it's important to understand that that's a component of it. So someone needs to be experiencing homelessness or does not have access to that food. Also to the comment about kind of cultural appropriateness and what's available, that was what was really exciting about seeing the YKHC program in action and work, where they've been very much able to make it work with foods that are really reducing the risk of diabetes in that community, considering transportation, considering genetic variation, considering all of the many components of making a program like that work, and where we've been working closely with them to understand what's working, what's not working, to help inform how we would go forward in moving a waiver if we get permission to do so. Another example is API. So around 60%-ish of patients who are leaving API either are underhoused or homeless in one way or another, or maybe far away from their home. So another possibility is thinking about how to use this waiver to pay for, again, medically necessary, time-limited housing for that patient. So I think about a patient I see in the emergency department who gets discharged from API, they had schizophrenia, they had a job, but now they had lost their job and they lost their housing in the process of dealing with their mental illness. They get admitted to API, we make a large state investment in their mental health, they're taking their medications, they're doing much better, they're no longer hearing voices, they're excited to go back to work and home. There's a lot of things to unravel to get back to that place. So they get discharged and they don't have a place to live and they don't have transportation to and from. And so it's really hard to get their meds. And so they may be showing up in my emergency department every couple days to get meds until those social components and those health related need components can be worked through. And so I think about a patient who potentially could be in a temporary housing so that they can get their driver's license back and they can get their job back and they can go back to their community and be able to be stabilized on their medication, because it can be a very large leap from an inpatient setting to an outpatient setting to be able to make all of those changes, particularly given all the ways that acute mental health diagnoses can lead to an unraveling of one's social support network prior to admission, such as jobs and housing. It can be very important.
So would this be like going to an assisted living home on the day, on a day rate type of situation? Are you talking about that type of temporary housing, or are you talking about paying for like an apartment or with caregivers? I'm just trying to see how this will play out.
Yeah, so Senator Wilson is the chair. It's really in how we end up scoping this work and how we end up looking. This is why if we get permission to go forward, we need to look at actuarial work to see where we're going to have the biggest impact. But where other states are doing is more like paying for temporary housing, like an apartment, where there may be a caseworker who's near there. So they wouldn't meet criteria for other already medically covered needs, such as a skilled nursing facility. So this is someone who wouldn't meet the criteria for a skilled nursing facility, therefore able to be discharged from the hospital, yet they don't have a home or house. So again, to take another YKHC example, you know, they have a recent home and housing building that they built. Could a patient then go back to Bethel and be stabilized there, get connected to their behavioral health services, make sure they're on their meds, and then be able to return back to a community or a village post-discharge, rather than having to make that really large leap from discharge from API back home.
Thank you.
For the record, Emily Ricci, moving on to slide 10. So, you know, really, what is this waiver talking about? We're talking about tailoring Medicaid to meet some of Alaska's unmet needs that we're seeing contribute to increasing utilization of healthcare services that are potentially avoidable if those unmet needs have been met. As we've discussed, and we all know, Medicaid is a state-federal partnership, and there's been new federal support for Medicaid innovation, particularly looking at some of these different unmet needs. And 1115 waivers are demonstration waivers. So they allow states to cover things that may not typically be covered by the Medicaid program for a specific period of time, typically 5 years with additional renewal periods, if they can demonstrate that those waivers have cost no more to the Medicaid program than the individuals would have cost without the services being covered under the waiver, and if they can demonstrate really that they have met the impact that was anticipated as a result of the waiver in terms of overall health outcomes and needs. So when we step back and try to think about any you know, changes or improvements to the Medicaid program, I always want to think about who are we serving. So again, what is the population that we're trying to focus on, even within the Medicaid population? And I think about the 5 and the 10% that are driving $1.7 billion in annual costs. What are we paying for? And as you've heard from the department before, our focus is really medium to long term. How can we shift the dollars that we're paying in the Medicaid program from paying for acute services to paying for either preventive services or to reduce the acute needs of services? And then how are we paying for it? And ultimately, this is all supported by why. Why are we doing this? We're doing this to promote healthy Alaskans, healthy families, and the Department of Health's mission to promote the health, well-being, and self-sufficiency of all Alaskans. And that's really our goal within the department.
For the record, Dr. Ann Zank, and this is another slide just really emphasizing kind of that goal overall to improve health outcomes and to decrease the downstream costs. We do know that healthy people are cheaper for the system, and we also know that healthy economies are built with healthy people. And so this is critical to kind of economic growth as well as sustainability for our state, and really shifting the way from this kind of high-risk Medicaid beneficiaries towards prevention, wellness, and addressing some of these unmet needs where we see it across the system.
So for the record, Emily Ricci, moving on to slide 13, why a bill, as we talked about earlier, SB 74 paved the way, I think, for the department to begin looking at 1115 waiver opportunities. The new opportunities that have been made available by CMS have kind of spurred, I think, all states to take a look at what they're covering and evaluate if there's opportunities that meet their state's needs to cover some different services. And as we described earlier, we believe a bill is necessary, specifically authorizing the department to apply for one of these waivers. Again, as we build out what makes sense for Alaska. So moving on to slide 14.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about this process, as I know there is some aspect of this that it gets approved by our partners in the federal government, and understanding that we're going through an election cycle and that might have some impact if there is a new administration. And so how might this, what are the impacts as if there is a shift in administration? Do we anticipate there will be some disruption to this process?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I can't speculate as to what a change in administration would necessarily mean in terms of disruption to the process. What I see is over 16 different states that have implemented or have negotiated with CMS some of these waivers, including Florida, Arkansas, Utah, Arizona. And so, you know, I think every administration can make different decisions about what they want to focus on and what they want to value at both the federal and the state level. But I believe, given the number of states that are pursuing this and actively working towards it, that it would be difficult to change direction so quickly.
And for the record, as Dr. Ann Zank, I would also add that we did ask this question to some of our TA partners, and we'll talk about that in the past. In the past, when an administration has made a decision to move forward with waivers, even with change in administrations, we have not seen a change in those waiver opportunities because, as mentioned, DC, Ricci mentioned, it becomes kind of embedded into the way that states do their work, and so it becomes very hard to undo a specific change at CMS like that.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci, moving on to slide 14. So these are some of the areas that we were speaking about earlier in terms of some of the new opportunities that CMS has identified and encouraged states to think about relative to 1115 waivers to address health-related needs. So we've talked about food, nutrition, and food security. We've talked a little bit about transportation, essentially to and from medical appointments, temporary housing and case management. Workforce development is a new opportunity that was recently approved in New York several months ago that we want to step back and take a look at as well. So this is kind of the range of activities currently that is being highlighted by CMS for consideration. And then moving on to slide 15, so financial considerations, we talked about budget neutrality, and I spoke earlier a little bit about some of the opportunities we believe may exist to pull down federal savings in advance and reinvest those in the system. What we are asking, what this would create some new opportunities in the system to address those unmet needs, but providers would need to be able to do that within the Medicaid program, and that might be a challenging transition. We're watching other states go through that as well, so we could potentially leverage some federal dollars to help support that transition and the infrastructure we need to make that successful. As we spoke about earlier, the legislature ultimately authorizes Medicaid spending, so any impact of the Medicaid budget would need to be approved by the legislature. And then Dr. Zink has described some of the efficiencies and savings other states have experienced with populations that have had these needs met. So moving on to slide 16, we just a very quick sectional analysis. This bill is a short bill, again, building off the work from SB 74, and there's only one section, and it essentially authorizes the department to apply for an 1115 waiver to establish one or more demonstration projects, and it defines health-related needs along the lines of the buckets that we saw in the earlier slide.
For the record, Dr. Ann Zink, as mentioned before, we have many states that we're watching kind of go through this process and a regular learning process. So to Senator Tobin's question of where we're at in this whole process, here's a little map because this can be a very complex process, and our state legislature is slightly different than other states, so how this works in different states. I would mention that unlike the 1115 behavioral health waiver that went through, this is not really replacing any grant-based services, nor does it have to happen across the whole state at once. So this can happen in pieces and over time with demonstration projects as they move forward. And when we've looked at other states, that's really what we've seen, because it takes not only a partner to offer these services, but it also takes the authorization to pay for these services, and both kind of have to go together. So we've been doing a lot of partner engagement, and I'll show a list of the different groups that we've met with, tribal engagement. We have sought technical assistance from two technical advisors to help us understand what's happening in other states, what waivers are most beneficial, what are the driving costs. And we are at that little, we are here now, legislative input and authority arrow on there. Moving from that, if we get approval from the legislature to move forward, we then need to do the hard work of actuarial analysis, really understanding what's going to make the economic sense for Alaska. And for that, we will need consultants, and we have secured funds to be able to do that. Partner engagement is going to be critical during all of this. We continue to hear from our partners. Simplicity was key, as well as making sure that they were engaged throughout the entire process, tribal consultation, and then waiver proposal and drafting. And then we need to go through the consultation process, and that not only involves consultation with our partners at the Center for Medicaid and Medicare, but also tribal consultation and public comment, then approval, and then the budgetary process, which brings us back here again, maybe next year, maybe the year after, because those two components may take longer than would be ready for next year. And then implementation. And again, this is where, when we've heard from other states, this can just take a while. It can take a while to think about who is going to deliver meals, how can nutrition services be able to be offered, and where we would see this as probably a regional and stepwise approach as different providers are ready to step into the services. And then, as previously mentioned, any waiver requires an ongoing annual review report to CMS, but an annual budgetary process, as well as the renewal services after 5 years. So it's a kind of a constant reevaluation process.
Before you go on to that slide.
Yes.
Do you have a time frame between one block to the next block if everything was in a perfect condition, isolated variables? How long between preparation to development, preparation to consultation, and preparation to approval?
Senator Wilson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I think I was not with the department when the behavioral health and substance use disorder behavioral 1115 waiver was created, but I would envision probably 1 to 2 years, depending on how fast we can move internally, how fast we can bring on contractors, and kind of the extent of questions that we work through between preparation and approval. In terms of implementation, I think some of that also has to do with readiness within the state in different regions and different communities in order to stand this up. And that I do not have a good sense of right now.
And Senator Wilson, through Chair, Dr. Ann Zink, I would say that we've been hearing from states that the implementation has been a challenging part just for providers to think about their service line differently and what that looks like. I will also say that just the process of conversation has been incredibly useful. I think people have learned how different groups are working across the state, and that is influencing, educating, inspiring, I guess I would say, different divisions within the Department of Health to think about other ways that things are being done. And we're seeing other changes happening now that don't require waiver because of this conversation to think about the whole person. So already it feels like the process has been very useful. And the reason we chose this river slide is because it feels kind of like that. We're getting all these bits and pieces of information moving in towards this river. And then how does that flow through into a waiver long term?
Then I will only echo, you have a concern similar to Senator Tobin's in terms of administration changes or no changes on the federal side in talking with Daniel Tsai, our deputy administrator from CMS, that it does matter how fast we move then because states, it is, waivers are based upon administration's priorities and they do change. And if we write them accordingly too, then they're more likely to approve. But having a mid-change of administration could be sort of disruptive to this whole process. So I would just ask for this. Yes, if you need more resources, then we're in that process now where legislature is here. Please don't be shy to ask and let us know how we can help the administration in terms of moving these priorities with the most expeditious process as possible with the resources that you currently have, but feel free to ask for additional resources if the department needs additional resources to complete this just because of that time and understanding, and that's from was from CMS. So we're just passing that on.
Senator Wilson, to the chair, we very much appreciate that, and I think what we see as our biggest limitation right now is just getting legislative approval, and we have a bunch of TA support lined up behind us and a team, and we've been doing a lot of the partner stakeholder, which is on the next slide, to try to be as ready as possible by the time we present it to you on what people are doing, getting input from our community members so that we really were sure before we brought it to you all, this was something that our community members were engaged in, that they were interested in, that our partners felt like they could stand this up and work with us to move forward. And you'll see the letters of support as well that have come in from this. And in, we've gotten overwhelming support, lots of questions about what this does and doesn't do. So there's a lot of education that needs to happen, as well as lined up for actuarial work if we can continue to move forward. So with that, that is where we're at. We really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you all.
All right. I appreciate the presentation and questions to the bill sponsor. Well, I thank you for not going in and sync speed and
learning.
I can't really have many more opportunities to say that. I do appreciate this, and I know that we were working, like I said, and lots of questions. I think every time we met with the department or the interim, it was, where are we at with Level 15 waivers? Where are we at with Level 15 waivers? So I do appreciate you guys coming forth with presenting this, and hopefully we can move this with our speed as fast as we can go in these bodies. Are there any other comments from committee members? Any closing comments?
Senator Wilson and members of the committee, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. And again, I would just say thank you for your support. Thank you for hearing the bill. And thank you for really offering the department the support that we need to be successful with this. So I appreciate it very much.
Well, we will go ahead and set an amendment deadline for Monday at noon on March 26th. And that concludes our business for the day. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I guess we should do that too. Mm-hmm. Let's quickly open public testimony. Anyone here in the room in Juneau wish to testify on SB 241? Anyone online? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And comments can be sent in to the HESS committee at shss@akleg.gov. And with that, on Thursday, we'll hold initial hearing on HB 89, Child Care Tax Credit Assistance, by Rep. Coulomb. And we will, that will all we will work on Thursday. And that concludes our business today, and we are adjourned at 4:54 p.m.